News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes. Our full length today, Bulldog Baseball, not till later tonight at 6 o'clock against New Mexico State. It is Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com. And before we get started, just a quick note. This past week, we lost two of my heroes here in the area. The Valley is blessed with so many men and women who served our country throughout our history, but notably in World War II, and a couple of P-47 aces went on this past week. Ed Roddy and Hal Comstock, two gentlemen that I had the privilege of visiting with and hearing some of their incredible tales, are no longer with us, and they will definitely be missed by anyone who knew them. So Ed Roddy and Hal Comstock, we thank you for your service and the great legacy that you leave behind. We're going to talk not about P-47s today, but about B-17s. And you may have seen the B-17 in Fresno recently. There's another one coming to Visalia very shortly. In fact, it'll be there. It's aluminum. Let me get the right name of this for you. I believe it's Aluminum Overcast is the name of this aircraft, and it's going to be in Visalia Tuesday and Wednesday, April 21st and 22nd at the Visalia Municipal Airport. That's the plane, the B-17 Aluminum Overcast. This is sponsored by the Experimental Aircraft Association. The local chapter will be hosting the event. I'll give you more information about that a little later in the program. But talking with us today is a gentleman who knows a thing or two about B-17s, and I think will be there in Visalia when the B-17 shows up as well. David Turner of Exeter, our guest. Mr. Turner, how are you doing today?
Very good, thank you.
Thanks for being with us. I know that you've talked to a lot of people over the years. You're going to be 92 this November. You've been married for 67 years. Those might be as impressive accomplishments as what you did during the war.
That's true.
But I want to talk to you about your time in the service. And before we get to your being shot down and escaping through the French underground and the incredible twists and turns that your story is going to take by the time this program's over, let's start with how you ended up in the service. Tell us about where you grew up and how you ended up serving Uncle Sam in uniform.
Well, I'll tell you, I grew up during the Great Depression. 1935, I graduated from high school. In 1940, I graduated from college. I had my first job with J.C. Penney, and they sent me to Anderson, Alabama. I lived in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 6 months, before I knew what was going on, they drafted me into the Army. In those days, you only had to serve 12 months, and then you were released to the reserve.
And that makes for some very interesting timing in your case, because you actually, you were drafted and got into the service in December of 1940, right?
Right, exactly, 6th of December, 1940.
And so 1 year would be December 6th, 1941.
Would be December the 7th.
Uh-huh.
Pearl Harbor Day.
So 1 year and 1 day from when you went in was Pearl Harbor Day, so technically you should have been out.
Right.
But that's not what happened.
Nobody would talk to me about going home, and that's understandable. And I was so unhappy with being a private in the Army for a year, I decided I needed to make a change. So I transferred to the Army Air Corps, where they teach you to fly.
Now, and you just don't say, this is what I want to do, and they say, sure, we'll let you. It's not as easy as that, is it?
No, it's not. You have to apply. You had to have 2 years college at least. Then you took an examination. Then you took a physical. And then you had a personal interview. And it all worked out good, thank goodness.
Well, you must have been pretty motivated.
I was ready to make a move.
Tell me, before we get into your training in the Air Corps, what do you remember about December 7th, 1941? How is it that you heard about what happened at Pearl Harbor, and what did it mean to you at the time?
Oh, man, it was a Sunday morning. I was out on the grounds in front of the base looking at the bulletin board for some signs of the fact that they're going to release me, and it wasn't there. And so I was really dejected, down in the dumps, wondering, what am I going to do now? But a few days later, an angel came along. Let me put it that way.
All right.
A lieutenant in the Army, in my same unit, knew my predicament, And he came to me. Now, if you know anything about military, officers and men don't get together. that's forbidden. But this guy came to me. He said, how would you like to get in the Army Air Corps and learn to fly, be a second lieutenant? And he said, what do you think about that? Man, I was in seventh heaven.
Were you wondering what's the catch?
Beg your pardon?
Were you wondering what the catch was? Did it sound too good to be true for you?
No, no, I was just elated. I mean, overjoyed. So, and he helped me. He helped me file out the papers. He helped me do all the work to get it going. And he really looked over me. And eventually, that's what happened.
What a blessing. So you end up in the Air Corps, and you decide, I want to be a pilot. And that's not such an easy process either. You have a whole bunch of thresholds that you have to cross in order to actually get that privilege, right?
That's right. That's right. You've got to go three stages of learning to fly, and you're checked every week anyway to see if you're up to date. You make the least mistake, and you might be washed out and go into some... Well, some of them became navigators, and some became bombardiers, but it was... You were on edge all the time. You were on a base where you were learning to fly. You were confined to that base 6 days a week. You could not leave.
Mm-hmm.
If everything was in order and you'd been a good boy, you'd have the seventh day off Sunday. So that kept you on your toes.
Well, and as fate would have it, a Mississippi boy ends up coming to Central California for part
right.
of his flight training.
Right. They sent me for ground school, which is the first you want to go to, and it happened to be in Santa Ana, California.
Uh-huh.
So I had a month of ground school. Actually, 2 months of ground school. And since I passed that, then they transferred me up to Visalia for primary flying school. And that was at Sequoia Field here in Visalia.
And that's the best thing you got out of your time in Visalia, right?
Oh, man. One day off on a Saturday... saw some girls walking down the sidewalk, and somebody in my group whistled. It wasn't me, but somebody in my group whistled.
Sure, it wasn't
around.
You.
Right. We inquired about what's to do around here. Is there a dance tonight? And yes, turns out there was. So we all said, well, we'll see you at the dance. And we did. And I met a young lady that changed my whole life.
What's that young lady up to these days?
Well, she's a grandmother, a great-grandmother. She knits and cooks and keeps everybody happy.
And how long have you been married?
67 years.
67 years, right. All because Uncle Sam sent you through Visalia to learn about flying planes.
All the way from Mississippi.
Sounds like somebody was pulling some strings there for you.
It sure does. Well, eventually I graduated from primary flying school in Sequoia Field, and I was transferred to Merced Army Air Base.
Mm-hmm.
That was for basic training.
So this is all progressing along, and I do want to fill in for our listeners here. We're talking to David Turner of Exeter, who's been married 67 years after meeting the love of his life there in Visalia during the war. Now, how long was it between when you met this lady after somebody around you whistled at her and when you guys got married?
We met about the 1st of July, and we were married in the middle of October. And so that's 2 months, 2 months and a half,
So you didn't want to wait. You didn't want to go overseas and make her wait for you. You wanted to take care of business right then.
And it didn't seem to be any other thought through my mind. And she agreed. So we were married when I was at Merced.
Uh-huh. And how long was it then until you shipped off overseas?
Well, it was 2 months at Merced, and I've graduated from basic flying school. And now they send me to Phoenix, Arizona, where Luke Field is. And there I trained to be a fighter pilot, single engine.
Mm-hmm.
And that went in 2 months, and then 1st of January, I graduated. Second Lieutenant David Turner. Now, that's a big change from draftee David Turner, Private Turner.
And what kind of, what planes were you flying at that point?
An AT-6, which is a single-engine fighter plane,
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you were thinking, I'm a fighter pilot, I'm going to go fly a P-40 or a P-47?
Right. I'm going to be a hotshot fighter pilot.
Uh-huh.
We graduated the next day on the bulletin board with my orders, B-17s. Well, in the predicament we had in the war at that time, we needed pilots in the B-17 program. So they were training the first pilot, and they were assigning men like me as the co-pilot, and I had on-the-job training as a B-17 pilot.
Mm-hmm. Ready or not, here you go.
You're right.
You know what, I think that's a good spot for us to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to hear about what it was like getting used to flying that big flying fortress, how those of you at home can see one of those B-17s in person coming up, maybe even see our guest today, David Turner, out there as well. We'll be right back with more of Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Familiar tune to anyone who has served in the Air Force or before that, its predecessor, the Army Air Corps. That's what our guest today, David Turner, was doing during World War II after initially being drafted into the Army and serving in the Army for a year. Then he began his pilot training along the way, meeting his wife now of 67 years, Phyllis, during a brief stay in Visalia. You can tell where he ended up, right there in Exeter, not too far from Visalia in Tulare County. You'll be able to see a B-17 in Visalia in the next couple weeks. I'll tell you more about that. As for that music we just heard, Wild Blue Yonder there, performed by my good friends with the Sounds of Freedom Band. The band is going to be in Visalia on May the 17th, playing a special ceremony for Gateway Church there. That'll be at 5 o'clock on May the 17th, free admission. At the Gateway Auditorium, the Sounds of Freedom Band will be there that week. Then the following Sunday, on May 24th, will be in downtown Fresno as part of the third annual Heroes of the Valley fundraiser. More on that at heroesofthevalley.com. And more now with David Turner. Where we left off, Mr. Turner, you had just gotten to know the B-17 after training in single-engine fighter planes. They hand you this big old thing with four engines and say, you better start working out because this is going to be a heavy thing to fly. Is that about right?
My first impression was, it'll never fly. It's too big. Too big.
Felt like the spruce goose to you, huh?
Yeah.
How long did it take you to get used to it and find
really,
a comfort zone?
Not very long. The first pilot was really a good man, a very good man from Carolina. And he took me under his wing and to his advantage, of course, because he needs somebody to help him. And shortly after that, he began letting me land the plane and filled me in very good. He did a great job. He was good.
I'm sure that made a big difference for you, being
right.
New to B-17s. What was the bomb group you ended up being assigned to?
I was part of the 94th Bomb Group, and they were assigned overseas to the 8th Air Force in England.
Mm-hmm. And this was 1943, right?
Early on. I remember flying north over the Atlantic on Easter morning in May.
Mm.
And we were flying from Newfoundland over Iceland to, what's the name of the little island on the other side of Iceland?
Greenland?
Flying over Greenland to Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
And then we landed there to refuel and spend the night.
And I can imagine you had no idea at that moment what you were about to experience in the months and years ahead.
Absolutely none. Absolutely none. Everything was new from that day on.
Were you anxious to fly some missions, to get some actions, or were you kind of apprehensive?
Oh, yes. Everything was great. It was gung-ho. Everybody's ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you ought to be if you got to fight a war.
Tell me about your first mission. Any butterflies that morning when you took off?
No, not really. You know, you're so busy doing what you have to do. The co-pilot isn't just along for the ride. He's got to watch the instruments on four engines. Engine oil, temperature, engine oil, pressure, gasoline. It's a constant job for the co-pilot. And then, of course, when the pilot feels like he needs a little rest, you've got to fill in for him. But you're so busy doing everything you have to do, there's just really no problem.
So you were a co-pilot on a B-17 in the 94th Bomb Group of the 8th Air Force in Europe. Did you fly one particular B-17 more often than not, and did that have any nose art or any name to it?
Yes, each team, each group had their own plane, and most of them had some kind of nose art on them. Mm-hmm. Our particular one was chosen to be a Buccaneer with skull and crossbones.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of it was Raider, R-A-I-D-E-R, the Raider.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them had some quite sexy, frilly girls on there, but we decided to go with the Raider. We were out for business.
You were out for business, and you kept it pretty clean,
yeah.
I suppose. And you being a married man at the time, that was certainly your best effort.
Absolutely right.
So what kinds of missions were you undertaking at this time? Do you have bombing targets and you're just flying over, dropping your bombs and going home?
On a day you fly a mission, you are awakened about 3 o'clock in the morning. Dress, get breakfast, and go down for a briefing. Everybody's in one big auditorium, and the commander tells you where the target is, what time you have to get into formation, what time you're going to get there, what kind of anti-aircraft opposition you will affect, what kind of help we will get from our own airplanes covering us, and what kind of opposition we will get from the fighter airplanes. So we're completely briefed on what it's going to be, and we're usually out at the plane and ready for takeoff about 7 in the morning.
And it always happened exactly like the briefing said it would, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Is that the truth?
It was uncanny how accurate
really?
The intelligence was on that, you know.
I was waiting for you to tell me that there was quite a bit of the unexpected that you ended up
The only unexpected things we nearly ever got into was the weather. It could be clear when we'd take off. The target would be clear because they'd have reconnaissance planes over checking for that. But by the time we got there, it could cover over, and we'd have to turn around and come back without firing a shot. So that's about the only thing we ever had trouble with.
What kind of camaraderie existed among the crew? Did you guys pretty much spend all your time together?
Well, we had 4 officers, navigator, bombardier, pilot, and co-pilot, and they nearly all roomed together. And then the gunner crews were enlisted men, usually tech sergeants, and they all roomed together. So it was pretty much a tight-knit group, you know.
Now, you talked about them telling you what to expect as far as ground fire, fighter opposition, whether you guys would have escort or not.
Mm-hmm.
What was the most daunting opposition that you remember facing, and how unnerving was it to know that you have to stay in formation, and if there's flak where you're flying, you just have to fly right through it?
You have to. Primarily, our fighter opposition was for the ME-109s,
mm-hmm.
Messerschmitt 109s, and the FW, the Focke-Wulf 190. And they were very good. And they would line up parallel with us, flying into the target, out of reach of our guns, and then they'd fly ahead of us slightly, and then they'd make a diving U-turn and come back through our formation head-on. And that was disconcerting. You see this little black dot turning in facing your formation, and then you see the little bright lights begin to wink along the edge of his wing. Then you know he was firing at you. But you can't do anything about it. You're flying your formation because you have to.
Wow, I can't imagine being in those shoes. What did you do to try to, I guess, process that? Is it all happening so fast that you don't have time to think about it, or do you find yourself saying a prayer? How do you deal with that?
Actually, you don't have time to think about it. You're busy doing what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did about 8 of those trips before we had any trouble at all. We'd come back with minor injuries or minor damage to the plane, but by and large, we had no major problem until about my 9th mission.
Now, what happened on your 9th mission?
And 9th mission, that's the day when I didn't come home.
And to put it in perspective, now this is still the point in the war where you were expected as a B-17 crew to fly 25 missions before you had a chance to go home, right?
That's true. And everybody was eager to get their 25 in so they could go home.
So you had 8 in and you're feeling pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But then comes number 9.
Well, we got a shot into the cockpit right behind the pilot. A 20-millimeter shell exploded. It cut our oxygen lines. It cut our hydraulic lines. And it started a fire in the cockpit. And that's something that's serious, because you can't, at 27,000 feet, you can't live without the oxygen.
So you have to dive.
The pilot has got to dive the airplane immediately to get down to where you can breathe. And with the loss of the hydraulic lines, some of the top turrets quit working, and we had no gun up in the top. Then the fire in the cockpit, that's my job, because the pilot's got to fly and get us down some way. So I'm out of my seat back there fighting the fire until I got that all put out.
And you had a fire extinguisher there?
I had a small fire extinguisher, and it had set a parachute on fire, really, with the hydraulic fluid. So I got that all out, and then the pilot had given the signal for bailout. That had been their plan. Out of the formation, we lost the protection of the formation. The fighters were chewing on us all the way, and their plan was to everybody parachute out and crash the plane, destroy the plane.
So let me just, I don't want to cut you off here, but just to make this all clear. Now, you've lost your pressurization, you've lost your hydraulics, you basically have a crippled airplane that's not so much of a flying fortress anymore, and there's still German planes shooting at you, and you've got to figure out a way to get out of this alive.
Right, and everybody else with us.
Whew.
Oh, well, on the way down, they were chewing us up. So the pilot gives me the order to lower the wheels. Now, that's the universal signal of surrender.
Right.
And then the fighters stopped chewing on us. Now the pilot says, everybody bail out. Well, he gave the signal, and the men begin to go out. And I, the pilot has to be the last one out, and the co-pilot is next to the last one out. Well, I'm on my way out, and I find my gunner back there holding his parachute, all burned. And he had no spare chute, and there was no way for him to jump. So I know we have to fly it down then. So I crawl back up in my seat and with some difficulty tell the pilot, we have to land the plane for this man to get on.
So he was not receptive to that initially?
Well, he couldn't understand because the noise was terrific and it was hard to make him understand exactly what happened. But when I finally did, he said, all right, pull up the wheels and we'll look for a place to crash land.
Holy moly.
So I pull up the wheels and now the fighters think we're trying to get away with it.
Of course.
And they start firing on us again. Well, that's the way we went down, and not too far away, there was a nice, big wheat field all ready for harvest, and the pilot decided that's where we'll land. So as we get on to final approach, he gives me the signal, wheels up again. We can't leave them down while we're landing in a rough land. Otherwise, the plane would cartwheel.
So I you're looking at belly landing in a wheat field.
Right. I pull up the wheels, and he makes a very nice landing in that wheat field.
You know, we've heard so much recently about the plane landing in the Hudson River and having been a glider pilot, how he was able to belly land that plane there. Had either of you ever had any practice in landing without wheels in a wheat field?
Oh, not likely.
Not exactly what you anticipate.
No, no. But it was a good landing, very good landing. And we finally slid to a stop, and everybody that hadn't already parachuted piled out, stripped off all their landing, all their flight gear, their Mae West, their parachute harness, their flying boots, their gloves, and everybody scattered, and so did I.
Now, when you touched down, I imagine this was a few nervous moments as you're bringing that plane in, because none of you have ever done it quite like this before. You don't know what's going to happen. Did you find yourself bracing yourself?
But you're so busy doing your job, you really don't think about anything else.
It just happens.
And it worked out just great.
Well, I'll say.
I piled out my side window, stripping off my gear, and I took off running.
And you know what? I'm going to stop you right there. We're going to leave you running somewhere in a wheat field because we're up against another commercial break.
Okay.
But when we come back, we'll pick up the story from there. David Turner, 91 years old, of Exeter, our guest today. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty. on 580 KMJ.
If you're snapping your fingers at home, you are not alone. That, of course, is String of Pearls from the late, great Glenn Miller. I believe that David Turner and his wife Phyllis danced to that a time or two. In fact, he just told me anybody can dance to that. But I think my wife might tell him otherwise. If you've ever seen me try that, I won't. Trust me. You don't have to worry about it. We're going to continue talking about David Turner's service to our country during World War II with the 94th Bomb Group. Interestingly enough, he mentioned being in Merced earlier in the war, and folks in Merced County today remember Castle Air Force Base. The former Air Force Base now has, of course, the great museum there. Joe Pruzzo and the game at, gang at Castle Air Museum do a wonderful job preserving history, and that is named for General Fred Castle, who also flew with the 94th Bomb Group. In fact, just before David Turner took off for his last mission, General Castle had, then Colonel Castle, I believe, at that point, had been named the commanding officer of the base for the 94th there. But, David, we're talking about your ninth mission. When you're shot up by German opposition, you lose the hydraulics, you lose the pressurization, you're forced into a dive, everyone's going to bail out, but there aren't enough parachutes, so you end up landing belly-style in a wheat field and then taking off running. As you're running away from that airplane, I have to imagine that it occurred to you there's a pretty good chance you're going to be captured by somebody.
That's right. And so we know that the faster we get away from there, the more distance we can put between us and the plane, the better our chances are that we will escape capture.
Now, do you all run off by yourselves or any of you together?
Well, the top turret man was following me and caught up with me, and he said, "Lieutenant, where are we going to go?" And I said, "Well, I think it's better if we scatter." So I said, "Why don't you go to the left here and I'll go to the right." And so we split up. And as I was running across the wheat field, I could see ahead of me a man, a woman, and a young man. And I thought, well, maybe there'll be some help to me. And I approached them and tried to talk to them, but they couldn't speak English and I couldn't speak French. But the woman of the house knew. She gave me she took a coat off her son's back. He was a teenager, mm-hmm. big as I was, and she gave it to me to put on to cover up my uniform.
Wow.
And she sent me on the way.
Now, what do you think the punishment would be for those people if it was learned that they had helped you?
Well, it was clear. The men were executed, and the women and children were put in a concentration camp.
So this was a pretty brazen move by her to help you.
Risky thing to do, very risky. And they were real patriots, you have to admit that.
No question. So where do you go from there?
Well, in the distance, I can see a clump of trees, and I thought, man, if I get in the trees, I can hide. So I hacked it over to the trees, and I spent the day in those trees. And I walked mostly, stopped and rest every once in a while, tried to listen to see if anybody was coming or if they had dogs tracing me or whatever. So I spent the day in the woods walking. And finally, as I was walking along, there was a sight ahead of me that I recognized. And then I realized I'd walked all day in a big circle. Oh, my goodness. I've heard of people doing it, but I didn't believe it.
Well, at least they didn't catch you while you worked
right.
in that circle.
Well, I turned around and headed back the other way, and there I found a country road paved, and I thought, well, maybe I can get out on that and go someplace. So I carefully stuck my head out the side of the road and looked up and down. One way there was nothing, but on the other side there were two German soldiers with rifles and standing in the middle of the road. So I pulled back in a hurry and spent the rest of the day there in the woods.
And they never came in there looking for you?
They never came in looking for me, no. After it got dark, I got out on the road and started walking. And I thought, maybe I can find some place down here where I can get in out of the... It was a little cool. I was cold, tired, hungry, hadn't eaten all day since 3 in the morning. And I walked, and I walked, and all I could find were wheat fields, wheat fields. And I thought, maybe if I lie down in one of the rows of wheat, maybe it'd be warm down there, maybe I can sleep. And I tried it, but it didn't work. So I'm up again, walking down the road, And now I'll find some fields where they have cut the wheat, tied it in bundles, and stacked it in big haystacks.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I can get inside of that and get warm, and I did. I went right on the backside, pulled out a sheath of wheat, crawled inside, pulled the block in beside me, and went to sleep.
It was as comfortable of accommodation as you could find, huh?
I just passed out, really. I just passed out.
Holy
and then next thing I knew, I heard voices. And I opened my eyes, and the bright sun shining through, and I heard these voices, and I thought, wow, I better look around a little bit. So I peeked around the corner, and there were some men across the road who were harvesting the wheat over there. So I crawled out of the backside of the wheat stack and brushed all the hay and the straw out of my hair and my clothes as well as I could and started walking down the road. And after a little while, I could see a few houses ahead of me. And as I approached those houses, a little old woman came toddling out and all dressed in black. She must have been old, maybe 60. And I thought I should ask her for help because I had been told, had been briefed, that if you're going to ask for help, ask somebody that's old who remembered World War One, not somebody young who was probably playing around with the Germans. This little lady came out in the middle of the road, and I approached her, and I took her by the hand, and I pointed up to the sky, and I said, American, American. And I showed her the wings that I'd taken off my uniform. She knew immediately who I was, grabbed me by the arm, took me across the road to a house where there were two other women who turned out to be her daughters. And they took me in. And the first one of them said, I don't know why she thought this, but she cooked me two eggs, a chunk of cheese, and a big chunk of French bread, and that was the best food I'd had in a long time.
Wow.
Gave me a bed and a bedroom, and I crawled in the bed and went to sleep.
A little more comfortable than the bale of wheat out in the field.
Oh, yes. I just passed out again, yeah. Then there were some more voices, and I opened my eyes, and there were men standing all around me. They had come home from work, and they were the men of the house, and they were all jabbering about what to do with this strange thing they'd found in their house. Well, they kept me there for two or three days, and the next day they brought in an English teacher to question me. They needed someone to talk to me. They needed to know that I was really an American and not a German spy trying to catch them. So this English teacher, who had a terrible accent, started questioning me. First, he wanted to know my name and serial number, and they took that because I think they were going to use that to verify with London by radio, if they got that far. And then he began to question me. He says, where were you born? And I said, I was born in Louisiana. Well, you know, that was the origin of Louisiana was French anyway. And then he said, well, do you know Baton Rouge? And I thought, what in the world is Baton Rouge? And then it finally dawned on me, he meant Baton Rouge, the capital.
Yep.
And I said, oh, sure, that's the capital of Louisiana. Now he smiles. He thinks no German would know that answer. And so it went well from there. Another one of his questions was, do you know Zinger? Do you know Zinger?
Zinger.
Well, Zinger, what in the world does he mean by that? Finally dawned on me, he meant Singer sewing machine.
Huh, how about that?
Oh, yes. And so I said, sure, that's a Singer sewing machine. Now he's grinning all over. Now he's sure that I'm an American. Everything went well after that.
Because, again, they had to make sure you weren't German because there were German spies posing as Americans.
Right.
And certainly if some of these French folks had helped one of those people, they would have been in big trouble, dead.
And they would run these men through occasionally just to find out if there was anything going on. And I said, the next day I said, what would you have done if you thought I was German? And he said, well, one night while you were asleep, one of them would cut your throat and we'd bury you in the backyard.
Wow.
Good Lord was looking over my shoulder that day, too.
I think Phyllis was saying a few prayers for you back home, too.
And somebody was, yeah.
So this is all happening in July of 1943.
Mm-hmm.
You and two more of your crew members were able to hook up with the French resistance, the underground, the way you did. But the rest of your crew, did they all end up as POWs?
Actually, all of them escaped or evaded capture at this time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was my understanding, I learned later, that four of them had been captured as they stepped off the train in Paris.
So they were close.
They became POWs.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of them evaded capture and escaped all the way.
Holy moly. I'll tell you what, I'm going to stop you there, and we'll take our final break, come back, and get the conclusion of this riveting story. Really unbelievable how things were smiling for you and kept you getting through all of these close calls. I can't imagine being in your shoes, but I want to hear the rest of it when we come back. The home stretch of Hometown Heroes straight ahead here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you are listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Paul Leffler with you on KMJ 580 and KMJ580.com. Bulldog Baseball coming up tonight. And don't forget, be in Visalia April 21st and 22nd at Visalia Municipal Airport. David Turner, our guest today, is going to spend a lot of time out there. You might even be able to meet him, look at some of his photos from his service during World War II. And if you are active military or a military veteran, you can tour that B-17 on the ground for free. If you want to take a flight, you will have to pay. But if you want to just tour it, if you're active military or a veteran, you get to tour it for free. Otherwise, it's $5 per person or $15 per family. And that B-17 aluminum overcast will be at Visalia Municipal Airport on April the 21st and 22nd. We were talking about France in July of 1943. You heard David Turner describe his plane going down, how he got away, how he was helped by some very kind-hearted and brave French people. And that's where we left off. You had been told, David, that if they had discovered you were a German, they would have slit your throat and buried you in the backyard. But you avoided that fate. Pick up the story and tell us how you did get out of there and get back home.
Well, I think they eventually had confirmed with London with their little radios that I actually had been shot down on the day. They verified my name and my serial number.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, with a couple of bicycles, I followed a man through the next town into a farm house. I spent a few days there, and then the lady of the house took me to Paris on the local train. She said, we will not talk, we will separate, and you sit separately from me. We got on, and she sat down right in the middle of a bunch of German GIs who were on the train and started giving them a bad time, calling all the attention to her and none to me. Got off in Paris, and a man grabbed me by the arm, and away we went. Never said a word, just pulled me away. And I spent a few nights with his house. And I was passed around quite a bit. There was one family I stayed with, a man and wife, and the man was blind, and he was a masseuse. And he and his wife would take all their paraphernalia and go to the patient's house and give whatever chiropractors do, I guess. Finally, one day, they put me on a train going to southern France, and a young girl about 14 or 15, went down the sidewalk bouncing a ball, and I followed her about a half a block away to the train station. There, somebody else picked up my arm, and away we went again. There were about 15 of us on this train trying to escape, and about half of them were French boys who were trying to escape the labor thing that they had to do in Germany if they got caught.
Mm-hmm.
So we rode the train down to southern France. On the way, you go from occupied France, which was where Paris was, into unoccupied France down south. And when you cross that border, they check your ID. I had a false ID that had been put together for me with a picture from a store there in town. Those things where you go and you put a quarter in the slot and you get your picture.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, while we were on the train, everybody was standing because there wasn't any room to sit down. Here came a German officer with a GI right behind him with a big rifle. He looked at everybody's travel papers.
I imagine this is getting pretty scary for you.
Yeah, and I had been warned about this, so I was ready for him. As he approached me, I had mine out. I had it open. And I pushed it right in his face and looked him right in the eye. He looked at me, and he looked at my picture, and he folded up and gave it back to me and went on. Another place where the good Lord was looking over my shoulder.
Amen. I imagine your heart was in your stomach, though.
Yeah. We went all the way south to Toulouse, France. And there we picked up a guy that would take us across the Pyrenees Mountains into Spain. Actually, he took us up to Andorra, which is a little country right up in the middle of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a few days up there before another party was formed, and we walked into Spain. As we crossed the border, gunfire behind us, everybody started running towards Spain. Then another group up in front of us with guns leveled. We had been captured again by the Spanish police. Yeah, illegal entry into the country was the charge here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they took us in, and everybody was jailed except two of us, one French boy and me. And we were released in the custody of another little English teacher who took us home for dinner.
And what made you two special? Why do you think you were treated that way?
I don't know. I have absolutely no idea. But anyway, he took us home and made a phone available, and we called the Barcelona British Consul. And we got our instructions. Go back to the local restaurant and hotel. Everything will be paid for. You don't have to offer any money. And somebody will pick you up in the middle of the night. And they did.
Hmm.
And we got into a rambling old Model T Ford and drove through all the back roads from this little town into Barcelona. When I got to Barcelona, I'd been instructed to get out of the car, don't stop at the gate, and dash right past the guard and go inside. And so I went inside and exhilarated at being on my way out. And in a very loud voice, I said, "I'm Lieutenant Turner. Who's in charge here?" Well, that didn't go over very well. They shushed me down and sent me back to the back room. And there they took all those old clothes off me that I'd been wearing so long. And I had shower and a shave and a haircut, a new suit of clothes, and a new set of identity papers. And I was in Spain, free of the Germans.
Wow.
Well, we had a few days in a hotel until they arranged everything, but one night we made an all-right ride from Barcelona to Madrid in a British car with a British flag on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a day or two in Madrid. One of the outstanding features of Madrid was the bullfight I went to.
Mm.
Never been to a bullfight, never went to another one. It's just not my cup of tea.
Well, I'm sure none of them would have been as memorable as that was, given the circumstances.
Well, we were given train tickets down to Gibraltar, where the border is with Spain, and we were instructed, when you get to the border, walk right on through. Don't even look at the guard. They will be bribed, and they will look the other way, and they did.
Hmm.
So I marched into Gibraltar to the American consul that was stationed there. And he was there just for this purpose, to receive people who come across like that. So he took all my new clothes away from me, gave me an old khaki uniform to put on. I was a second lieutenant now, and he got out a little cigar box full of insignia, and he says, "Lieutenant, I don't have any insignia for a lieutenant, but here's a captain's bars. Put this on and wear it till you get to London."
That's a good way to get a promotion, huh?
Well, I caught a Navy plane from Gibraltar over to Marrakesh in North Africa. And I remember walking into the mess hall there, food galore. Boy, was it good. One of the things that impressed me most, though, was bread. It was white bread.
Mm.
And the first thought that came through my head was angel food cake.
Mm.
I hadn't seen white bread in I don't know when. Well, I got a ride down to the airport at Casablanca, got an airplane back up to London, reported in to the general, and that was it. Home free.
Wow. What an incredible journey that is. You ever thought that this would make a good movie?
Wouldn't be as good as Casablanca.
Oh, I don't know. Sounds like it might be better to me. What an incredible story. Unfortunately, David, we're out of time on the program today. I do have about 30 seconds if you want to tell me what, how magical it was when you finally got to see your bride, Phyllis, again.
Well, I finally got some leave and caught an airplane from the East Coast to the West Coast in Fresno. And gasoline was scarce and rationed in, so I didn't want her to drive up to Fresno and use all that gas. So I waited for the bus. I got a bus down to Visalia, got a taxi to Exeter, walked through the front door and said, "I'm home." That was it.
Wow. Well, I don't think it could have gone any better than that for you. What an incredible story. What a beautiful story. And thank you so much for sharing it. Thank you for serving our country and for leaving this legacy for the rest of us to try to live up to. And I hope a lot of you at home will go see David Turner at the Visalia Municipal Airport April 21st and 22nd when the B-17 aluminum overcast is there. Maybe not quite like the Raider you were flying over Europe in 1943, but a pretty good impression. David, thank you so much. Have a great day.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That's David Turner, our guest today. This has been Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.